Money Psychology. Money Psychology.
Every time you reach for your wallet, check your bank balance, or make a financial decision, you're not just dealing with money. You're reliving every money lesson, fear, and belief you absorbed before you were old enough to understand what any of it meant. I'm Elliot Graves, and this is Money Psychology, where we explore how your earliest financial experiences created the money mindset that controls your financial life today. Welcome to Money Psychology, Money Psychology. Have you ever found yourself making a financial choice? Maybe buying a certain stock, or even just choosing a brand at the grocery store, and feeling a strange underlying anxiety that you can't quite place, a sense of urgency about the future? I've felt that acutely. For me, living on a coast that sees more and more extreme weather, that anxiety has become a low, constant hum. It's made me question things I took for granted about long-term planning. It's less about a 30-year retirement plan and more about, well, what the world even looks like in 30 years. It's a deeply personal and unsettling shift.
Exactly.
And from a behavioral finance perspective, that's what I find so fascinating and, frankly, a bit alarming. We're trained to analyze market signals, interest rates, and company performance. But what happens when the biggest variable is the planet itself? I've started seeing this ripple effect in the data, this emotional undercurrent that is silently redirecting billions of dollars and shaping our financial identities in ways we're only just beginning to understand.
And that is precisely what we're exploring today. We're pulling back the curtain on something that affects every single one of us, whether we realize it or not.
We're calling it the financial mirage, and we're going to decode the profound, often invisible, impact of climate change on our money behavior.
We'll be looking at how this global crisis is reshaping everything from our daily consumption habits to our most ambitious investment strategies.
This isn't just an environmental issue. It's a fundamental money psychology issue. So get ready, because today we're asking, what happens to our financial health when our planet's health is in crisis?
Let's start right there, with that emotional undercurrent.
I see it manifesting as a kind of temporal distortion in people's financial planning. The traditional 30-year mortgage, the retirement plan that matures in 2055, these long-held pillars of security suddenly feel fragile, almost fictional. People are asking, what am I actually planning for?
And that uncertainty is precisely where new, often irrational behaviors are born. We're seeing a massive, almost panicked migration of capital. Not just people moving, but money. It's fleeing from risk.
Think about insurance companies quietly pulling out of entire regions, coastal Florida, fire-prone areas in California. They're redrawing the maps of where it's safe to invest in a future.
Oh, that's a chilling thought.
It's like a silent financial evacuation that most people don't even know is happening. So while a family is buying their dream home near the coast, the underlying financial infrastructure that makes that dream viable is what? Just packing its bags?
It's already left, and this creates a devastating psychological trap.
We see this concept in the research on climate migration, these trapped populations. People who lack the resources to move away from an environmental threat.
But this is a financial version of that. They're trapped in an asset that is rapidly becoming worthless, or at least uninsurable.
The very thing that was meant to build generational wealth becomes an anchor.
It becomes a liability, and the psychological burden of that is immense.
How do you plan for your children's future when your single biggest asset could be quite literally underwater or wiped out by a wildfire with no financial safety net to catch you?
And it disproportionately impacts certain communities, doesn't it?
It can't be a coincidence that the populations with less mobility, often lower income or historically marginalized groups, are the ones left in these newly defined financial risk zones.
That's where the data is just brutal.
It's not a coincidence at all. It's a direct consequence. Limits on resources and systemic gender or racial norms severely constrain a person's or a community's adaptive capacity.
So while a wealthy person might see climate change as a reason to diversify their portfolio into, say, renewable energy tech, a working-class family sees it as their insurance premium doubling, then disappearing altogether. The problem becomes so immediate, so existential, that there's no room for long-term strategy. There's only room for crisis management, and that is a profoundly different psychological space to be in. It short-circuits our ability to think about the future, forcing us into a state of perpetual financial defense. Your entire money mindset shifts from growth and security to pure day-to-day survival. That phrase, perpetual financial defense, it lands so heavily. It's not just a strategy, it's a cognitive state. It's living inside a fortress, but the threat isn't a market crash you can wait out. The threat is the weather. It's the ground beneath your feet. How can your brain possibly compute long-term growth when your most primal instincts are screaming, "Danger is here right now"? It can't. It literally short-circuits the prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain responsible for executive function, for planning. All that energy gets rerouted to the amygdala, the brain's alarm system. We see this in behavioral studies all the time. When people are under chronic stress, their discount rate for the future skyrockets. $1,000 in 10 years feels worthless compared to $100 today. So, the future literally becomes less valuable to our brains, dramatically so. And this is where we see this strange, almost paradoxical split in behavior. On one side, you have this surge in what I'd call hyperpreservation. People buying gold, stocking up on non-perishables, looking into off-grid living. It's a very tangible, physical attempt to build a tiny, personal lifeboat. A retreat from the system entirely. But what's the other side of that coin? Because not everyone is building a bunker. No, the other side is a kind of financial nihilism, a YOLO mindset but born from anxiety, not optimism. We're seeing spikes in spending on ephemeral experiences, extravagant travel, luxury goods, especially among younger demographics who feel that the traditional promises of saving for a house or retirement are, well, a mirage. Oh, that's heartbreaking, actually. It's not indulgence. It's a form of grief. You're spending the money now because you're grieving a future you don't believe you'll have. It's a coping mechanism. Both behaviors, the hoarding and the splurging, stem from the exact same root cause: a profound loss of faith in the future, a loss of faith in the systems that were supposed to guarantee it. So, if your entire financial identity was built on being a planner, a saver, a builder, and those concepts suddenly feel obsolete, who are you? That's the core question, isn't it? Your identity shifts from being a planner to being a reactor. Success is no longer measured by the size of your retirement fund, but by your perceived agility, your ability to pivot. And this is where the market is already adapting in a way that is, frankly, a little terrifying in its brilliance. How so? Companies are no longer just selling products. They are selling the feeling of adaptation. They are selling agency. Think about the marketing around an electric vehicle. It's not just about fuel savings. It's about being part of the solution, about taking control. Look at the rise of sustainable investment funds. Right. It's a way to soothe that climate anxiety through a purchase, to feel like you're doing something, even if you're just one person. You're buying a sense of control. The product isn't the stock portfolio or the electric car. The product is a temporary relief from the feeling of powerlessness. And that is perhaps the most potent commodity in the 21st century. Wow. The most potent commodity. So the mirage isn't just the illusion of a secure future. It's also the illusion of control that we buy to make ourselves feel better about that insecure future. It's a hall of mirrors. It is, and that's where this gets so complicated from a behavioral standpoint, because on one level, taking these actions, buying the EV, choosing the sustainable fund, it does reduce anxiety. It aligns your spending with your values. That's a psychologically healthy thing to do. But it can also create a dangerous sense of complacency. Right. The feeling that, okay, I've done my part. I've bought the thing. It soothes the individual conscience, but might actually slow down the collective momentum needed for real, systemic change. You've treated the symptom, but the underlying disease is still raging. And the market has no incentive to cure the disease. It has every incentive to keep selling you more effective, more expensive treatments for the symptoms. That's the fundamental conflict here. We're trying to use the tools of a system that thrives on consumption to solve a problem caused by, well, consumption. It feels like the one thing that gets lost in all this, in the data, the market trends, the panicked behaviors, is a sense of grief. We're talking about it in financial terms, but at its heart, it's a profound emotional loss. A loss of the world we thought we were getting, the future we were promised if we just followed the rules. I don't think we talk about that nearly enough. The financial world is allergic to words like grief. It wants quantifiable risk, not sorrow. But you can't build a resilient financial plan for this new reality if you don't first acknowledge what you've lost. You'll just keep trying to rebuild a house that the tide has already washed away. So, maybe the most radical financial advice we can give right now isn't about asset allocation. It's to make space for that grief. To sit with the anxiety instead of immediately trying to spend it away, whether on gold bars or a trip to Bali. To ask yourself, what am I actually afraid of here? I think that's probably the only place to start. Because until you do that, you're just a reactor. You're a puppet, and your strings are being pulled by fear, by anxiety, and by a marketing machine that understands that fear better than you do. The first step toward agency isn't buying something. It's understanding why you feel so powerless in the first place. And maybe that's the ultimate takeaway. The financial mirage isn't just about the external world being less predictable. It's about the internal stories we tell ourselves about money, security, and the future. And those stories are, they're breaking. They no longer work. Our challenge is to find a new story. A story that's less about guaranteed outcomes and more about resilient processes. Less about building a fortress and more about learning to be a better sailor on a very, very stormy sea. It's a fundamental shift in what it means to be financially secure. The next time you make a financial decision that surprises you, whether it's an impulsive purchase or an overly cautious investment choice, ask yourself, whose voice am I hearing, and what childhood memory might be driving this choice? Understanding your money psychology doesn't guarantee better financial decisions, but it's the first step toward making choices based on your current reality, rather than your childhood fears and dreams.